nations revealing your majesty.
That was Tim Hecker with the song I'm Transmitting Tonight from his 2017 album Radio Amor.
Maybe you don't feel it at all. out before if I'd realised. I've forgotten all time. About it, George. I'm sorry. Will you forgive me?
Yes. Number nine.
They are standing
upon the telegraph.
Number nine.
Watusi, the twist,
Eldorado.
Take this, brother. May it serve you well.
Maybe it's not
what?
That.
What?
Maybe even then. Exposure is something that's difficult to bear.
Radio art there from the Beatles with Revolution Number 9 with John Lennon twisting the radio dial along with the other sounds. Here's Dymaxion with some radio art. It starts with Chase Scene with Transistor Radio and leads into the Haunted Radio. We'll be right back.
to Radio Survivor. Our guest on the podcast today is Anna Fritz.
I mean, I was really interested in thinking. I was making radio to think about radio. I was really fascinated by that.
Anna Fritz is assistant professor of film and digital media at the University of California at Santa Cruz and joins us today to talk about her practice of making radio art and teaching the history. We started off today's podcast portion before the radio program begins in about 10 minutes, talking about some of our forays into making sound art. And Paul Rees-Mandel of Radio Survivor had posted anonymously on the web some of his sound art. He was talking about it casually with his friends, and before we knew it, we were having a conversation that was worth sharing and worth recording. So that is why I'm telling you that what you're about to hear is us having a conversation about creating our own work and how we went about it. And that leads in to today's interview with Anna Fritz. Paul, too. Paul's been making art. We were talking about how Judy Dunaway was like, I'm just making anonymous art.
Oh, right? Yeah, Jennifer probably didn't see my my latest creation.
Yeah.
No. It
freaked me out. I was worried about me.
It's it's a song that's entirely random. So the beats are literally random.
That's beautiful.
It's all a key.
Paul's going to tell us, Anna, Paul's telling us about his sound art that's anonymous
I actually used an MP3 player and just loaded up equivalent length samples. And so it's samples of the drums from the first two bars of When the Levee Breaks, because those are like iconic. But if you chop them up and take them out of context, it's really weird.
Yeah.
And also the MP3 player doesn't do everything exactly right. Like, you'd think it would play everything, it would be all in time, but it actually loses and gains time.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, I guess that's just an artifact.
What MP3 player are you using for this?
Sansa
for this
Clip
work?
Jam.
Like, and then, and so then you edited your video just randomly? The video wasn't linked to the...
Yeah, more or less, yes, correct. Okay. The video wasn't linked. And then I played in samples of a Mellotron, and then I picked a key, so things would be sort of semi-consonant. We can do non... I figured...
But... Then, most importantly, and most distractingly,
I chopped up Alex Jones ranting about QAnon.
Oh.
And then also put that in to play randomly.
Alex Jones hates QAnon.
Yeah.
So if there's ever been something that you could be amused by, it's that Alex Jones hates QAnon.
It's short. Because there's, you know, everyone's got a limit on what they can take from that. And I'm not trying to make Metal Machine music.
Mine is none. I watched it and I was upset. I watched it and I was upset.
I can't wait.
The thing I know about When the Levee Breaks is that when I was living in Montreal, I did a workshop this like almost 20 years ago at the Hotel Tatango, which is sort of a famous studio there run by some of the Godspeed people. And one of the things we did was, like, we replicated the recording of the drum kit on When the Levee Breaks in order to talk about boundary miking.
Fun.
And we totally did it.
Wow.
We completely reproduced the sound of When the Levee Breaks.
With that, like, natural slapback going on?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was about how things are miked. And also, it's like, because it's only three mics. And then, of course, they were in a stairwell. So we used the stairwell of the building. And we had, you know, there was like a group of 10 of us. And so one person was like a drummer. So they just stuck the kit down in the stairwell. And yeah, it's like one mic on the kick, one overhead, and then one boundary mic, like way up the stairwell.
Boundary mic. What is a boundary mic?
What is a boundary mic? Well, here, let me move over to my microphone so I can make sure that I'm in the right spot. Boundary miking is the practice of miking the edges of where you might perceive sound. So normally, if you're recording something, you have the practice of sticking the microphone close to someone's face if they're speaking, or close to an object that's making a sound, or pointing in the direction of the thing that is making the sound that you want to capture.
Right.
But if you're boundary miking, it means you point your microphone like right next to the wall or right next to a reflective surface so that you catch the immediate resonance of a reflection of the sound off of a surface of some kind.
And then you usually mix that with the microphone that's more traditional. And then
that's
you have a decision.
Yes. in terms of like how you manage that mix. And so what it can give you is this sense of roominess or distance. It can also give you this kind of broadness to the sound. It can also focus the sound in strange ways. Like if you were in a space that was full of glass, for instance, like you could make things seem more sharp. Like you could just change the disposition of the sound by boundary miking and where you put it in the mix.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. And there's so many implications in my mind right now because of how many recordings are just being made in bedrooms. Like, you know, how I just watched a wonderful sound, musical performance, you know, like everything that I've seen that I've liked this year has been, more often than not, a performance of by a musician in their bedroom. And it's like, so there's no, there's not a lot of, I haven't seen any boundary miking in people's bedrooms because we're missing spaces is the point, the weird point that I'm trying to make and then be quiet. Like there are so many spaces to record sound in other than this one intimate thing that we've all accepted as the main way for sound to sound right.
Well, this is also the aspect, I think, of recording at home or being in the home is that there's an expectation of that intimacy and that kind of lack of echoic space or active space. But recording at home also includes all of these extras, like the washing machine and the water running in the pipes and your neighbor and like the leaf blowing and whatever. You know, like there's a lot of other interstitial sound that's kind of interesting and or annoying, depending on what you're working on. But the expectation that the sounds you make will have no relationship to other spaces is always false. And this is what I really love about radio, is that you always assume that whatever sound you're making for radio is going to have a relationship to unknown, unstable spaces. And we can't possibly know what those are, but we can imagine all of the possible variations that they could be. And so making a choice about how that listening will take place is the hallmark of how you compose for radio instead of composing for, you know, like a CD player, for instance, or just like a release on the internet.
When you're talking about that, it makes me think about the station where I volunteer. We play a lot of experimental music, and people joke that the number of times they've been driving in a car and they're trying to figure out if they're hearing a problem with their car. Is that my car or is that KFJC? You know, because there's a noise. And that's happened to me where I've turned down the radio because I'm trying to figure out if what I'm hearing on the radio is in the other ambient space around me. Is it a siren outside? Is it an issue with the car? Or is it the music that I'm hearing from my speakers?
Yeah, it's great because it throws you back into a relationship with the space you're in. It's like, oh, what's here and what's coming from afar and what's coming from closer. Like, I think a lot of times we're not listening in a very, in a very focused way, because you're just trying to get through your life. You're having your thoughts, you're making your dinner, you're driving your car to some place where you have something that's going to happen. And maybe that's what's on your mind. And that moment when you're like, I can't really tell where the sound is coming from, that thrusts you back in your environment, even briefly, is very interesting.
Why is that different from, If you were listening to a CD in your car or an MP3 or something, what is the difference between that radio transmission or something, your own music that you've chosen to listen to?
Well, because you chose it. So you know the beginning, the middle, and the end, and you're making a decision about being committed to testing out that amount of time. Perhaps you've listened to it more than once. But when it comes on over the radio, you're trusting the curation and the choices of somebody else, and you actually have no idea what's coming next.
Right. Even though, you know, I have like a My Bloody Valentine record that still occasionally convinces me my stereo is broken because the speed modulations are not with the tempo and things like this. Or it makes, you know, and so while it's not quite the environment, it's also like, is my electricity weird? Did my turntable break? What is going on?
My favorite albums of the 90s had labels on them that were like, your stereo is not broken. We did this on purpose. I have one album by The Boredoms, a Japanese noise rock band that is, they used skipping CD samples in their composition. And so you have a CD with the sound of a skipping CD being
played. But you habituated to it, right? Like, I finally know
maybe,
my turntable isn't broken. Yeah.
But those are always the things as a radio DJ, even when you're playing experimental material like that, when things like that happen, your heart stops a little bit, or if there's a very long pause in a piece, you might think that there's something wrong with the equipment. So it's interesting that you can have that experience as both a listener and as the person controlling the equipment.
I mean, I think also some composers and artists really work with that. Like, you know, recording something that is so minimal, so kind of borderline. I'm thinking about Steve Roden here, that it's like you have to really zoom in order to try to hear it. You have to really turn up the volume. You have to listen to it multiple times to understand what composes all of the layers. And that kind of listening is never going to be the dominant force in the room. It's always going to be a kind of undertone in the room. That's how it's meant to be understood. Whereas I also enjoy super loud big things, you know. And I also think that, you know, radio stations have historically underestimated what the listener is willing to engage with. You know, the internet's a really good example. People will listen to all kinds of crazy stuff, and people will listen to it, you know, 800 times, 800% slower than it's supposed to be for hours and hours and hours at a time. And that's not an avant-garde practice anymore. That's just like people on the internet doing stuff. So I feel like that there was a moment, at least from the 90s into maybe sort of the 2010s, where it was really hard to make experimental radio and expect it to be broadcast any place that would pay you even a dime in North America, because there was such an aversion to risk for a listener. It was like, no, we want the didactic explanation of how you're going to feel when you listen to this thing. We want explanations at the top and the bottom. There can't possibly be any unknown space in this radio. And independent radio is the place where those things were still happening, where you could listen to something weird overnight that had no explanation, or someone, you know, put it on and then never told you what it was, because then the programmer left and the next programmer came and they didn't know either. So, you know, those moments of real surprise were kind of relegated to independent radio. And I'm hoping that they're going to sneak back into the mainstream a tiny bit, because, you know, more avant-garde composing and a lot of musical variety has really hit, like, television scoring and film scoring. And I feel like the kind of like hyper-real pop, sort of hyper-synth pop, I guess I should say, not really hyper-real, it's like hyper-unreal, that folks are listening to is just like a total mashup of every genre possible. So, you know, people's ears are definitely more attuned to things that are experimental now than they used to be, but that was not being reflected in radio listening, like as a broad practice in North America for decades now.
And you see that shift happening. Do you perceive now? I mean, you sort of put a time demarker like 2010, and you've just cited a few reasons why you think it sounds like you're perceiving the popular ear is adjusting to novel sounds or things that were once considered avant-garde, which seems to some extent to be a process that is always ongoing.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree for sure. I mean, I think I'm not going to, like, I won't claim like a historical moment exactly as being the fulcrum for things shifting, but I think it also has to do with just generally, you know, a sophistication entering into, let's say, video game sound design and just a different, I guess, funding model being applied to television and filmmaking, so that there is more possibility for something that's kind of would be considered challenging or unusual to become more popular. So, you know, here I'm thinking of something like the soundtrack to the Chernobyl television series.
Oh, yeah, good point.
You know, which is this incredible piece of industrial music. You know, it's fantastic.
Terrifying.
It's kind of hard. It's hard to imagine that kind of a work getting such mainstream approval even just 15 years ago in a way. But on the other hand, it's exactly the right concept for that film, you know, that it's a soundtrack that's entirely composed from industrial field recordings from a defunct a nuclear reactor site. And you know, it's been, it's all that material has been treated very musically using software that also enables that to happen. But there's almost no, there's basically almost no instruments whatsoever in the soundtrack. There's just a human voice and then field recordings that have all been treated in ways that are very extremely musical and also just, as you say, sort of massive and industrial and kind of terrifying in the best way possible. Like, it's an amazing soundtrack.
Welcome to Radio Survivor. We're here for the love of radio and sound. My name is Jennifer Waits.
Hello, everybody. I'm Eric Klein.
And I'm Paul Rees-Mandel.
And on the show today, we are going to focus on transmission art and radio art, looking at both its history and some contemporary examples. Our guest, Anna Friz, is a sound and radio artist and scholar and is assistant professor of film and digital media at University of California, Santa Cruz. Thanks for joining us on Radio Survivor.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So on the show last week, we talked to Judy Dunaway about the history of sound art. And so it's kind of exciting to have you on this week to talk, to broaden this discussion and talk more about transmission art. And in our conversation with Judy, we talked a bit about definitions and how definitions can be a bit tricky. But I maybe wanted to start in that same space with you and ask how you define radio art and transmission art and radiophonic art, to help us just add some context to this discussion.
Sure. I feel like, you know, much like the sound art world, you know, that there are different ideas of where a definition might come from or what a definition might entail. So for instance, radio art, if we think of it from maybe more the European perspective, is certainly radio radio practices and programming that are made to experiment with the conditions of radio, but are kind of like art for radio. So straddling the worlds of experimental music, radio plays, performance poetry, like sort of coming from those areas, field recording, sound recording, and kind of composing in all of those a variety of ways with the knowledge that broadcast reaches an audience in a different way than at the, let's say, over that last 100 years than a recorded musical medium or than a live performance where you can see the audience. So radio art is definitely meant to be in that sort of in-between space of radio production, where you might draw on things that are fictional, or you might draw on things that are real. You might create something that is an impression. You might work with textures. You might be there might be voice. There might be no voices at all. There might be instruments. There might be no instruments. But definitely that world of radio art has a certain set of aesthetics associated with it, which very much are sort of tied into what we could call like Western art music. So a kind of avant-garde electroacoustic practice, you know, sort of early electronic music ideas, and so forth. If I think of radio art from the North American perspective, and keep in mind, this is just my opinion here, like I'm not sort of subscribing exactly to one thing or another, but my background is coming from community radio in Canada in the 90s, in the early 90s. And so for me, when I understood that radio art was even a possibility or a category, my relationship to it came from groups like Negative Land. It was like cut up tape and using radio that was specifically referring somehow to the platform of radio that was expressly about the relationship between the studio and the listener and all of these unstable, interesting ambiguities that exist there. So for me, I came from it much more from like a noise, media sampling, a spoken word to some degree, maybe like electronic noise, later field recording kind of approach. But I would say it was just a little more like dirty and lo-fi and kind of punk rock. And when I first moved from producing only in an independent Canadian radio context to, you know, making my first piece on Austrian national radio, I was just sort of shocked in a way to be in the radio studio in Vienna that was, you know, at that point, I guess, was 70 years old. And you know, these ancient reel-to-reel players and technicians who would sort of do my bidding. And I was a bit like, this isn't how I make work. Like, I have cart machines and tape loops, and I just sort of sit in the production studio and kind of cue it all up and then perform the damn thing, because I didn't have a computer at that point. I didn't have any knowledge of computer editing. I made everything on tape. So for me, radio art was really enabled by this volunteer-driven, community-based, independent context. And those are the aesthetics that I sort of began with. And I would say they still affect me very much.
What station now, were you working at?
I was at CITR in Vancouver.
CITR in Vancouver.
Which is made famous by Nardwar the Human Serviette being the CITR mascot and probably longest running on-air personality there.
Known for his interviews of music personalities, correct?
That's right. Known for his insistent nerdery and very detailed interviews, very insistent and detailed interviews, and his plaid tam. So.
How do you, I know I'm taking us a little bit off on a tangent here, but I think it'll help inform the overall subject. How do you make the jump from working in a community radio studio at CITR in Vancouver to then being invited to state radio in Austria?
Well, it's a strange life. I mean, in Vancouver, I had the great good fortune of being in a community of artists and makers, and I at that time was still just, I guess, kind of coming out in a way as an artist. I had felt that because I hadn't been to music school or art school, that being an artist was something that I couldn't really do. I was sort of in I was doing street theater. I learned to play an accordion so I could be in a clown band. You know, I was into performance art. And,
me too.
And so all of that somehow fit well with also radio. There's a performativity to it, but there's also a remix aspect. There's a way that you're asking questions, but you're also making things. And those really appealed to me a lot. And so I became the program director at CITR, and I was that, which meant I was also the person who was training everybody on our equipment. And so at a certain point, I just started realizing, like, oh, I could make really a lot of interesting sounds here. I don't need to just play the sounds of other people. I could be making the sounds. And so, you know, we went from making like ridiculous long tape loops to trying to figure out how to harness the power of these little cart machines. And for people who are not aware of this arcane piece of radio equipment, it's like a cartridge in the same way that an 8-track cartridge functions. It's a sort of endlessly looping piece of tape that's in a little plastic cartridge. And so once you've played whatever's on that loop, it auto cues back to the beginning.
Right. So
it's very convenient.
It's a piece of professional radio gear from the 80s and 90s that, you know, plays it plays like a
commercial or
yeah,
a PSA
commercial or a
is
promo.
What it's intended to do. That's
and it loops so that you never have to rewind it, and that's why it would exist in that form. But then it has so much potential for art. Artists have unlocked a lot of ideas just because of how this one piece of professional radio gear was designed.
That's right. And I mean, at that time, as I say, I didn't really know how to use a synthesizer or a sampler or anything like that. So I was just figuring out like all the equipment at CITR that I could get to loop. So whether that was an open, like a Revox reel-to-reel machine, whether it was cart machines. Once we had mini disc, I figured out that certain mini discs had seamless loops and others did not. So you had to figure out which one that was and make sure you had the right one. But the holy grail of looping was a really big deal at that point, I remember.
It is a golden age of looping these days.
And so also in Vancouver, there's a very strong history of artist-run culture. And so what that means are media arts centers that are started by artists, run by artists, that are funded by public funds, mostly, you know, from the Canada Council for the Arts or other funding that are available either provincially or federally. And what that enables is just a really robust scene for artists, especially at that time when it was really expensive to have your own computer or have your own camera or have your own equipment, your own microphones. So you could be part of an artist-run center and there would be the possibility to borrow or rent things and to take workshops and learn how to do things. And so the Western Front in Vancouver, which is one of Canada's longest-running artist-run centers, and also a place of famous, at least well, I would say internationally, but certainly in Canada, for all of its video experimentation in the early days of video. The Western Front was a really important place for me to realize that there was this bridge from the radio station into worlds that included sound art and media art. And that's also where I learned how to build a very small 2-watt FM radio transmitter based on the Tetsuo Kagawa plans. I'm happy to talk more about him in a little while. Japanese media theorist who kind of transformed a lot of artists' lives with these very small transmitter plans. And it helped me to realize that the radio that I was making didn't only need to be tied to a broadcast studio. It could really be pulled out of the studio in a sculptural way, in a performative way, in a sort of artist social practice kind of way. And from there, I really started making work really full-time as an artist. And because of the Western Front having a long-standing connection to Austria, because of also their involvement with Fluxus in the 70s and 80s, and their connections to some of the people who had put together the first radio art program on National Public Radio in Austria that was really dedicated to radio art and not, you know, radio plays or Hörspiel, as is maybe more common in other German sort of traditions. So having that connection gave me this pipeline to become part of what was going on in Vienna at Kunstradio, which is this Kunstradio, literally meaning art radio, this program on the National Public Radio in Austria. So it was a really great example where like an artist-run culture and a community radio station were able to connect with other places internationally that had a similar sort of independent interest but were housed within a larger institution.
And I mean, that's a great place to explain more about what the studio was like and how in Austria. So I take it they had a much longer tradition of radio art. And so how did the studio, how what was the difference between that and your DIY scene back at home?
Well, also because, you know, CITR Radio, which is in the meantime, also spiffed up its studio incredibly. They have a gorgeous studio at the UBC campus now in Vancouver. So shout out to that. But you know, in the old days, it was still a really well designed studio for the budget we had. Like we made a lot out of nothing. Let's just say, but it was a bit like being in a submarine. You know, it's like there's no windows, there's stickers all over the walls. Somebody had cut out all of these old editions of Bloom County comics and stuck them like wallpaper on all of the hallways. So, you know, it was just kind of scrappy, and you know, we have this. These production studios that are modeled precisely on the same equipment that's in the on-air studio, which is of course meant to be convenient for training and for volunteers to sort of increase their ability and their skills. But it also means that you have all of these machines that are identical, so you can do really interesting things with like three Revox reel-to-reels and running the tape across three different machines and doing these sort of tape tricks that are in many ways, the bread and butter of early electronic music.